The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski and I'm once again with you in the studio after a week of very little voice to speak of. Well, it's good to be back and be able to make myself heard. Hear me roar. On this week's podcast, we're finding out about the latest frontline defense in the new malware battleground, smartphones. We're also hearing about Adobe's latest announcement. They say they will no longer develop Flash for mobile browsers. What is behind this game-changing decision? Also in the headlines this week, Google relaunches their Google TV service and PC supplies may run out in the run-up to the holiday season due to the devastating floods in Thailand. Joining me to shed light on these stories is Charles Arthur, technology editor of The Guardian. Charles, it's good to see you back in your place again.
Down, boy. Below the salt.
I hope you didn't get used to the dizzy heights of this side of the studio.
No, indeed not.
Also joining me is Michael Brunton-Spall from the development team on the third floor of Guardian Towers. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Alex. It's always nice to be here.
Over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian, we will have all these stories and more. So keep listening. Adobe's Flash Player is one of those services that many people thought would be around forever. The system allows content that's built into the computer language, from animation to video on The Guardian's website, to be viewed in a web browser. Without Flash support, people are unable to enjoy these little nuggets of entertainment and information. Flash has recently had a rocky patch, as the Apple iOS has not supported it, and that has had a whole community of Flash developers rather put out, which we've covered on a previous episode of Tech Weekly. They recently made an announcement that will get these coders even more infuriated. Adobe said this week that it will no longer support Flash for mobile browsers. Charles, why are they doing this?
Well, according to an interesting blog post by Mike Chambers, who's one of the evangelists for Flash at Adobe, the reason is because they just couldn't get the same ubiquity for mobile as they do on the desktop. So the Flash Player plugin is on about 95% or upwards of desktop machines. But when it comes to mobile, it wasn't on iOS, as you said. It is on Android. It's not on BlackBerry. It's in rather limited form on Symbian. It's not on Windows Phone, and there's no indication that it's going to be. So actually, when you looked at the mobile platforms, it was pretty much not on many of them. Now, Android obviously is the biggest one, but the problem there is that it's very fragmented. And so what Chambers said was this effectively meant if you wanted to use Flash to deliver a rich web experience in the browser on mobile devices, you'd have to provide both a Flash-based and an HTML5-based solution. Now, this doesn't really make a lot of sense, given that most of the browsers on mobile phones these days, smartphones, are able to cope with HTML5. So Adobe took a decision, which is, look, why are we putting all these people into developing a Flash Player plugin for mobile when actually HTML5 is going to do the job anyway, and HTML5 is coming down the track really fast. Lots of people are developing for it. It's really big for Apple, which is, you know, even if it's not the biggest slice of the market, is very intensively used. So they just put it all into HTML5.
So this isn't necessarily a death knell, given that it has such a high proportion of desktop. But is this, you know, does this indicate some kind of HTML5 creep? Can we see the dissolution of Flash in the future?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are about 1.4 billion PCs out there, and you've probably got probably more than a billion which can play Flash in one form or another. But the number of smartphones out there is increasing by about 100 million or more every single quarter. So this year alone, you'll have had 400 million added, and there were already something around that number in the market. So you can see that by the end of next year, you're going to have about as many smartphones enabled, which can do the internet just as well as the number of PCs. Now, for Adobe, why would you keep on developing Flash, given that people who develop stuff for Flash, it won't work on the mobile? Why would you do that on the desktop as well? Why wouldn't you start shifting things just ever so gently over towards HTML5 on the desktop too, given that Microsoft doesn't look like it's going to distribute the Flash Player plugin by default with Windows 8?
Michael, here at The Guardian, we do have content that is Flash It's developed in Flash and so therefore requires the plugin. How is this announcement going to affect what happens here within the building and for developers in general?
So we've been experimenting for some time with HTML5 forms of interactives. Like most news organizations, we generate a lot of the interactive content in Flash because it's something that we have a library of old routines that we can reuse over and over. Many of the interactives are connected, are very similar, and it means we can build them very fast. So when breaking news happens, we can build something very quickly on that.
What kinds of things will listeners recognize?
So some of the things that we've built in the past include many of the bouncing balls that we generate. So, for example, for the World Cup, we had the balls that represented what activity was happening on Twitter over time. The first one of those we built in Flash, but we did a more recent one, which we built in HTML5. And our interactive team have been working very hard to drive JavaScript and HTML5 forms of interactives to ensure that all users can view them. And I think one of the primary reasons that as a news organization we've been doing that is the increasing number of viewers readers of the site are looking at it on tablet devices, many of which don't have Flash on them, particularly the iPad and the iPad 2. But even some of the early Android tablet devices didn't come with Flash players that worked fully. So only the newest ones are starting to do that.
So it sounds actually like the anti-Flash brigade, has done its job pretty well. If behemoths, if large media organizations are making these shifts, then it sounds to me like this is potentially a death knell.
There is a lot of Flash haters out there. A lot of people don't like it for accessibility reasons, for the control that Adobe has, for the security implications of running Flash. But for news organizations, often it's about the speed of development, and Flash was very, very good at that. I think one of the reasons this has started to happen is that we started to see an increase in competitors to Flash in HTML5 in terms of things like Tomoko's Hype, which is two ex-Apple engineers who built an application much like Adobe Flash for developers that let you build HTML interactives that look like Flash. And Adobe has even bought out their own one, Edge, which is the equivalent, allows you to take your Flash movies and turn them into HTML5 and make them very easily accessible.
Well, that's on the development side. What about for the consumer, Michael? So what about all the legacy Flash content that, whether it exists on the Guardian site or exists, on the World Wide Web out there? If the Flash player goes the way of the dodo, what effect is that going to have on all that content? Are they building obsolescence?
Yes, indeed. In fact, that's one of the reasons that people don't like Flash is that as compared to if you go back and look at Tim Berners-Lee's early versions of the web, you can still read that in a modern web browser. However, things that are built in very early versions of Flash are not guaranteed to run reliably. And as Adobe dies and the Flash product potentially dies, those bits of content will disappear completely, and things like archive.org can't archive Flash content. Whereas HTML5 interactives, the chances are all the semantics are there. That's what makes them so accessible to screen readers and stuff like that, which means that you can read them and can view them even as browsers advance.
Well, you mentioned archive.org. It's a pretty important system given that, there is all this content that is on the web. Archive.org and, things like the Wayback Machine, they are attempting to create a giant library of our digital histories. So this is an important thing.
This will probably be an important thing. I should imagine that somebody will have to generate some way of reverse engineering Flash files at some point in order to put that content into archive. And that's not that bigger stretch to imagine, but you can imagine 30 years down the line that if nobody has Flash, you'll go back and there'll just be a blank spot in some of internet history where people won't be able to see some of those early YouTube videos and cat skateboarding as much.
It'll be like all the
fantastic first novels written on Amstrad PCWs. I mean, it's interesting too that Microsoft is talking about, or the noise is coming out of Microsoft that Silverlight, which is its sort of Flash-like plugin, may have breathed its last, do you think?
Yeah, this one is really interesting. So Microsoft really knows how to annoy a developer community. So when they did their last conference, they downplayed Silverlight in preference to some of their newer HTML5 solutions that .NET was providing. But one of the some of the rumors that are floating around now are suggesting that there will not be a version of Silverlight after Silverlight 5. Now, as far as I can tell, most of the people using Silverlight are using it because it supports DRM video. And there aren't many other Silverlight applications that I'm aware of out there that are significantly using it. So possibly this is why Microsoft have decided to downplay it.
And DRM video, what can you explain that?
Oh, so that's a rights-managed video. So video that you can't share or rip or download onto your device and use in any way that you wish. Instead, you have to use it in exactly the way the original filmmaker intended, which is something that many of the free HTML5 kind of developers really like, the idea of being able to access video in any way, shape or form. But obviously a lot of content producers would rather that people only got to watch their videos once and had to pay them if they want to repeat it and so forth.
So Charles, the future, it sounds to me at the moment as if the trend is moving HTML5 and JavaScript. Those are the languages.
Oh, yeah, it's completely unstoppable. And it'll be interesting to see what will happen with Windows 8 devices next year and the extent to which, I mean, I suspect that there won't be a Flash Player plugin for the Windows 8 devices that run on ARM architectures. There might be for the Intel ones, but I think it'll be a pretty difficult one because that would be a whole rewrite of Flash. And if they're not putting the effort into Flash on mobile, they might think that Flash for ARM tablets just isn't worth doing.
Well, now hear that, developers. And you can read up on the Flash fallout at guardian.co.uk/technology. Well, you can't fault Google's chutzpah. When the search company decided to take over the world, they really did mean it. They've tried to crack almost every media market, from word processing to mobile phones to social networks and TV. Some of their attempts have been enormously successful. Others, not so much. One of the latest flops has been Google TV. When the system was released earlier this year, it landed like a giant wet pancake. Accompanied by bad reviews, the system failed to fly off the virtual shelves, leaving hardware partner Logitech with a bad business decision, hundreds of millions of pounds out of pocket, and ultimately without a CEO. But undeterred, Google have announced a relaunch of the service on its mobile operating system, Android. Charles, what's different this time?
Essentially, access to the Android market. That's the sort of the really big change that's happening in Google TV, which is still only really available in the US. The Logitech example is interesting because they had a sort of set-top box called the Review, which I have to say I did bring one back from the States. So I spoke nicely to Logitech and they did let me bring one back. But the Review may go down in history as the only device where in the first quarter of 2011, they actually got more back than they sold, because people bought them in the Christmas quarter and tried them out and said, this thing sucks really badly, and took them back in such numbers that having sold $18 million worth in the fourth quarter of 2010, they sold $5 million worth and got more than $5 million worth of them back in that period. So, you know, the Review, I think, it outshines the Kin and the HP touchpad in terms of the awfulness that it inflicted upon the company.
And you know, Playbook and Waterworld and Ishtar.
The Playbook is still the iceberg that is trying to just rip a big gash in Rim's waterline, but we'll come to that another time. So anyway, the Review, yes, inflicted something in the region of $100 million losses on Logitech, which is, you know, a company that you and I know for making keyboards, mice, you know, sort of add-on peripherals and things. They also do video conferencing and stuff. So, you know, Google sort of meanders on with Google TV, which no one has haven't quite managed to say why it is a good idea, apart from Google, who think, well, yeah, we'll get some adverts from it. But everyone else goes, there's not actually a great deal of video out there on the web that we want to watch. You know, these things called TV channels, they're quite good at deciding, you know, things to watch. I don't get the X Factor on you know, YouTube any better than I get X Factor on ITV. And if I want to tape it with a cheap PVR, then I can. Yeah, being able to get at YouTube actually isn't so great on television.
But isn't there something to say for Google's ability to at least attempt to innovate, to push these things out? It's like a giant lab.
It's like a giant Microsoft. Well, no, it's like a small Microsoft. You know, it's sort of, it tries, it fails. It tries it again, it fails. And possibly by version 3, it might be getting it right. In the meantime, there have been hardware companies who had sort of stranded desperately by the side of the road, who've beaten themselves up trying to make stuff and left gasping at the effect.
So, I mean, is there any difference in the market now from when they tried to relaunch it? I know it also has a new user interface, which was one of the main criticisms of the review back in the day. So, you know, can that actually make a difference? What is the difference in the market now from when they first launched?
The thing they really need is content, and content is the thing that they don't particularly have a great deal more of.
But they're not a content company. They're a service
They're not a
company.
Content company, but to do TV, you need content. You know, TV simply does not work without content. It's one of, you know, otherwise you have a big box in the corner of the room sort of showing you funny black and white spots all the time. You know, it's really not a great idea.
Or a test card, yes. I mean, Google, ultimately, it has, Michael, a track record of failing. And, in this industry, that's something that's often celebrated. You know, they fall over and then they pick themselves up again and then they say, well, we learned and now we're going to launch Google Plus, for example.
It's a company uniquely positioned to fail regularly because it is the places where it outshines everyone else are such money makers for it, and nobody else can come near to beating its ad revenue at the moment, which means that they just have surplus of cash and surplus of engineers that they can keep throwing at problems. The convergence of digital technology into the front room is something that people have been chasing for 20 years. You know, people have always envisioned the idea of having this mystical device in your front room where you see all your entertainment and you make your phone calls and your beloved ones come up on the wall and can chat to you via video phone, and you can update all your friends in Google Plus. And Google would like to be there. They'd like to be the center of that. Google Music would let you listen to your music through that device. Google TV will let you watch the TV, will let you browse the Guardian site, will let you read your news from Google News, will let you talk to your friends on Google Plus. These are the ways that Google wants to be part of your everyday life. Whether you think that's a very creepy thing or whether you think that's a really positive thing is another matter.
Yes, well that's a whole different conversation.
But I mean, the question is it a money-making thing for Google? I mean, they have Android, which may be making them some money, maybe not. It's a bit hard to tell.
But Google are uniquely positioned again to capitalize hemorrhage cash, but they're uniquely positioned to capitalize on making other companies unable to compete in those areas. What they want is to know more about what people want to do anonymously, so they don't really care about you and what you do, but they care about you as a 19 to 24 year old, or they care about you as a young male who lives in London, or they care about you as a young female who lives in Scotland, and what kinds of things you listen to, watch and read. That information is useful to them, not necessarily directly valuable, but by making all these products available free, music is free, TV is free, so forth, that ensures that they get in there and they are the ones who can harvest that data, and no one else can compete with them because nobody else has the wallet to compete with them.
It sounds very much like we know what side of the is Google creepy or not fence you sit on, Michael. Michael mentioned competitors in this space, Charles. Who are Google TV's competitors?
Ironically, one of them is Samsung, which is normally thought of as a sort of partner in this space. But Samsung has its own app store of smart TV apps and claims approaching 10 million app downloads. The trouble is, whenever I've asked Samsung, okay, so how many TVs is that to? How many apps per each of these smart TVs? They go all quiet. They're really happy to give you a headline number, but they're completely unhappy to give you any sort of detail that would let you build up a picture of what the smart TV market looks like. And it was interesting that the CES earlier this year in Las Vegas, the Consumer Electronics Show, you couldn't move without falling over someone else who was showing off smart TV or Google TV. It's one of these things. Do you see them out there? I've got to say, I don't. Possibly I live a sheltered life, but, you know, TVs are not selling in a big way. And my impression is that for all the talk, it's not happening quite as much as these companies would like it to happen. I mean, 3D TV was another big one. Not happening either.
Speaking of, though, my mum, she's just bought a 3D TV that's got all the bells and whistles. So I'm wondering if, my mum's, she's pretty tech forward. She's not as tech forward, say, as the people around the table here. But, it's something that is starting to trickle into the public consciousness, I would say.
How much 3D TV has she watched?
Well, she hasn't bought the TV yet. It's coming soon. But, yeah, I mean, Absolutely. It does have to do with content. And so who are building apps and who's building things for this platform? You suggested that you haven't really been able to get a sense of Samsung's interactive TV market. Is anybody building stuff for Google TV, and what kind of stuff are they building?
Well, really, that's what all the you know, there's a number of featured apps. There's things like QVC for Google TV, AOL HD, Fox News, but hey, you could get Fox News if you're over there, Wall Street Journal Live, Pandora, Clicker, Twitter. The Guardian is going to have Google TV content. So, you know, if it takes off, we're well placed. If it doesn't, hey, we're just where we were before. LG is expected to come up with some Google TV hardware next CES, so you know, hold your breath for January for that. But my feeling is that it's really only going to start working if it's built into the TV, if the TV isn't any more expensive than the other, and if you can turn it off.
Michael, is this a gap in the market? Because all the partners, all the headliners that Charles is talking about are... they're pretty traditional media. You know, they're big media. Is there a place for, you know, Joe or Jane, bedroom app developer, to come up with something that will be whiz-bang and for your TV?
I think it depends on the size of the market, the installed market that you actually get with the TVs. So if only 40 people buy them, then there's not really any value. Even if you sell your app to 100% of the users, you're not going to make a lot of money. On the other hand, if they do take off, if they manage to find a really good market and lots of people can start getting these TVs, then this is the perfect place to go and find something, because many other applications and games won't work on that form factor in the way that somebody's thinking when they're looking at the TV. They're not playing it like they play a mobile phone. They're not on the bus and have 5 minutes to spare. They might want a more deep immersive experience than they would otherwise. So you can start to imagine some of the games that didn't work on your iPhone or didn't work on your iPad might work a lot better on the TV.
So diversification for the app developer community, not just for your phone, but also for your TV. God, it's sounding very, very complicated. More on Google TV as it rolls out. Finally, in the news this week, the market research company Gartner has announced that PC sales are down by 11% in Western Europe, with not great news coming out of Thailand, where the devastating floods have affected the suppliers of PCs. Now, Charles, what's behind this slump?
The fall in the PC market isn't yet due to the Thailand floods. Those floods have affected a lot of the hard drive manufacturers out there, and that's expected to start kicking in the fourth quarter and the beginning of next year. But the sales slump in Europe in the third quarter seems to be partly down to the economics of the situation, that you know, people are just not feeling great economically. When you're not feeling like that, you don't tend not to buy big ticket items. But a key thing that fell was netbook sales. These fell by 40% year on year. That was the biggest sort of category sale. So, for example, desktop sales fell by 8.7%. The whole of the mobile PC market, so that's netbooks and notebooks, fell by 12.8%. So it's netbooks, the little ones, which had the biggest fall, and that seems to be a general passing out, really, that netbooks are starting to fade out of the picture.
As tablets really take off.
As tablets have started to take off, and also as notebooks have just started to get cheaper, so that you know, you can get a better featured notebook for about the same sort of price, you know, a bit of a £50 price delta perhaps compared to what a netbook might cost.
Where are PCs selling, Charles?
They're selling in China, they're selling in the Far East, and that's where the growth market is for PCs. And it's very evident if you look at the general numbers that all the expectations for growth are, and I was looking at some Gartner numbers last night, all the expectations are that the emerging markets, so that's Far East, Latin America a bit, and particularly China, that's where the growth opportunity is, and those are expected to grow by something like 8% compound over the next 5 years, whereas in the developed markets, the market for business is expected to grow at less than 1% compound per year, and the consumer market at 2 or 3%.
And so they're not looking at places like Africa or some developing nations?
That doesn't seem to be on the radar, particularly. Africa's not a big PC market, as much as anything, because of the capital cost of buying a PC, the electricity demand. You know, in countries like that, you're better off selling a smartphone.
I met a guy last night from who lives in Nigeria, and he says that it's such a wet place that you can get mold inside the technology, which is obviously not very good for your technology. And also, they're constantly busted because of the surges in electricity. So these are other things that need to come into play when you're thinking about something that sits on your desktop. Mm. So yeah, I mean, mobile phones may very happily leap. Why would mobile phones not leapfrog PC sales in places like Latin America or China? Why are they still interested in buying desktops?
Well, I think that actually the number of the smartphone penetration will leapfrog PC penetration. I think there'll be a number of points where people will choose to buy a smartphone instead of a PC in those countries. I mean, the reason with emerging markets is just that they haven't got as many PCs. Generally, you know, the penetration is nothing like it was over here because they're emerging countries, you know, emerging economies. They just didn't have as much money per head as we did. And now that they're catching up, you know, people are starting to equip offices and things. But the power of the smartphone is that it just means that people can do much of the same things without needing to buy something that's very expensive, that's difficult to lug around, that will run out of charge in a couple of hours. You know, compare that to a smartphone. You carry it around all the time. It's got the internet in your hand. It'll last a whole day on a single charge. Why would you not?
Incredible how far we've come. Well, more on this and the rest of this week's news as it unfolds at guardian.co.uk/technology. In the last 18 months, there has been an explosive rise of malware on Android phones. This malware comes from downloading apps, and it can do everything from send SMSs and capture keystrokes. 47% of mobile malware is on the Android, and the Android is the biggest smartphone platform in the world. Charles, you spoke with Kevin Mahaffey, who is the CEO of Lookout. What did you find out from him?
Well, he started up this business because he thought when he was at university that it was going to be an interesting area to look at. They were looking at things like Bluetooth vulnerabilities. And they then, he and his co-founders, got into the whole idea that smartphones actually might be a new area of vulnerability. And at the time when PCs were all the rage, PC vulnerabilities, he was looking a bit further ahead. This was sort of 2003, thinking, well, actually, smartphones could be interesting. There could be some potential there. And so he built Lookout, the Lookout security company, up with the presumption that smartphones were going to be where it was. So I began by asking him whether we should really be worried about mobile malware.
The security implications of mobile phones, in my opinion, are actually very similar to computers. I think that the best thing you can do for security is to think of your phone as a computer. So if you download applications, there are bad apps, malware and spyware, that you can get on your phone, much like you can get on your computer. Similarly, attacks, phishing attacks, where you might get an email that claims to be from your bank, but it's not actually from your bank, trying to get you to disclose your username and password is there. And then, of course, because your phone travels with you, it knows who you are, where you are, who you talk to, and all sorts of other information, whether personal or related to business, that there's a large privacy issue on mobile devices, that it's important that people look at how they use their phone choose or make decisions that reflect their own privacy preferences.
How does this sort of malware tend to get onto phones? Because as I understand it, you reckon there are these two vectors. There are the sort of web attacks, and Android and Apple's iOS are both vulnerable because they both use WebKit, or else there are people downloading apps themselves. Of the two of those, which do you think is the greater threat?
So right now, downloadable applications are where essentially all of the malware is. On mobile devices, you might download an app from the Android market that is malicious, or you could say click on an advertisement within a legitimate app that takes you to a website that downloads an application. I think it's worth mentioning that that's where we are today. Though some of the larger threats on the PC world actually took advantage of security flaws in the operating system or in web browsers or plugins, whereas you simply visit a web page and it hacks your computer. I think that's a large potential risk for mobile devices, though it's worth mentioning there hasn't yet been a large security problem associated with that. And so with security, it's a combination of responding to the issues that are here today and helping people stay safe there, but also thinking ahead in the future and asking ourselves, you know, what are the drivers for attacks? Is it for profit? Is it for notoriety? Or is it for God and country that people actually choose to attack devices, and to understand the methods by which these actors might do it and hopefully get ahead of it. And in my opinion, an ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure.
You've got a very sophisticated system in place to try to detect malware almost, or malware apps, almost before they come into being. Just to explain a bit about how that works.
We started with the assumption that mobile threats are going to grow substantially faster than PC threats. If you look at how quickly smartphones have grown, PCs took, you know, 2 decades or more to be mainstream and be in everyone's house. And smartphones have really only taken a few years to be in everyone's hand. And I think that threats are likely to encounter a similar curve where you have, you know, organized crime groups who are seemingly the most likely perpetrators in mobile malware thus far, likely to be taking the learnings they've had on the PC and applying them directly to mobile. So there's an increase in sophistication that you almost have all the sophisticated malware on the PC being taken to mobile pretty immediately. And we said in that case, we can't afford to build a huge research team, 900 people throughout the world, to analyze apps all day long, which is to some extent how a lot of research team exists in the desktop space. And so we had this thesis, you know, the what I just mentioned, coupled with your phone already doesn't have enough battery life and barely has enough power to work. So we can't really put much on the device. And so we took the approach of let's do everything in the cloud on server side, so that we've essentially turned malware from a human analysis problem into a data mining problem, where we have tools that automatically download apps within, you know, 3 to 5 minutes from when they're published on a market and are analyzing them, oftentimes before these apps are ever on a person's device.
You're not actually running the code. You're looking at where was it published, who published it, what does it seem to be, how big is the code, all the sort of things that are more like metadata about it.
So we look at the metadata, how apps relate to each other is important, and also what's inside. So we have tools that don't necessarily run it on a device, but we have server tools that can understand what happens when it would run on a device. And what I'm excited about is the promise of being able to identify malware in the markets before a person even has to download it. And in a lot of the time, we can actually get it removed from a market before anyone's touched it.
So you had one instance where you say that malware is often tried out in little areas, sort of off the main market, to see how it'll work. And then it shifted over. And you said that there was one case where you identified an app that was innocent that you thought was going to become malware.
So on mobile devices, there are a number of markets. You have official markets like the Android market produced by Google, and you have geographically targeted markets such as those in China. And at least thus far, a lot of the malware has targeted Chinese markets or appears in Chinese markets first, and they may subsequently appear in the official Android market. So in one case, we found a given piece of malware was in a Chinese market, and then we found an application that was correlated to that in a US market, in the official Android market. And that correlation was enough to say, you know what, this is likely to turn bad. And we've seen upgrade attacks where somebody will put a legitimate app in the market, wait for people to download it, and then once you have a number of people download it, upload a new update to that app that's in fact malicious, and then all of those people get that malicious update. And so we liken this to pre-crime, where we can tell what malware is likely to do or what an author is likely to do before they do it, because we have a huge data set that allows us to understand what's happening in markets all over the world, correlate that data together. And I think that gives us, the good guys, a much better chance at keeping mobile devices safe than we ever had in the desktop.
So generally, should people worry about the safety of their mobile handset? What's the approach people should take?
I never think worrying solves much other than to make people, you know, more anxious. And we're certainly not selling anxiety medication, so I won't advocate that people worry. Though I do think it's important that people understand what the threats are so they can protect themselves, understand, you know, that you should download apps only from reputable places. It seems like common sense, but many people often will download apps from any website they visit. That you keep your phone up to date, that you set a passcode on your device, and, you know, take common sense principles that you've done that you may have done on the PC, but don't really realize that you need to do on the mobile device. But at the end of the day, I think people can stay safe on the devices, and there's really no need to worry. But it's important that people stay vigilant, that people not be become nonchalant about using their very powerful computer in their pocket.
Kevin Mahaffey from Lookout. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks, of course, to Charles Arthur and Michael Brunton-Spall. Next week, we are previewing the biggest games and gadgets of the holiday season. So come back with plastic at the ready. I'm Alex Kratosky, and the producer this week was Matt Hall. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.